Today is Wednesday, January 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia welcomes U.S. participation in efforts to end Ukraine conflict as Secretary of State Antony Blinken heads to the region.
The State Department says Secretary Antony Blinken will visit Ukraine this week and meet with President Vladimir Zelensky as tensions between the U.S. and Russia escalate.
Germany says it is ready for a, quote, high economic price, unquote, to defend its values over Russia's sanctions.
We have no other option but to defend those common rules, even if this means paying a high economic price.
Wirtschaftlichen Preis hat.
And policy aspirations collide with political realities as President Joe Biden marks his first year in power. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow would welcome U.S. participation in diplomatic efforts to end the conflict in eastern Ukraine. But with tensions rising between the U.S. and Russia, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The State Department says Secretary Antony Blinken will visit Ukraine this week and meet with President Vladimir Zelensky as tensions between the U.S. and Russia escalate over signs of a possible Russian invasion. Blinken will be in Kyiv to show U.S. support after diplomatic talks between Moscow and the West produced no agreements last week. The Biden administration's accused Russia of preparing a false flag operation for a pretext for intervention, a charge that Russia denies. After visiting Ukraine's capital, Blinken will meet with his German, British, and French counterparts in Berlin to discuss a possible response to any Russian military action. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow is not threatening anybody with anything, as tensions remain following inconclusive international talks. AP correspondent Charles de Ladesma reports.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's not threatening anybody with anything, as tensions remain following inconclusive international talks. Lavrov criticizes the US and NATO following recent separate meetings for showing what he describes as an obvious double standard. Lavrov explained that negotiations cannot accept any demands regarding the actions of Russia's armed forces on our own land. Washington and its allies firmly rejected Moscow's demands during last week's set of talks, which were held as an estimated 100,000 Russian troops massed near Ukraine in what the West fears might be a prelude to an invasion. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Germany says it is prepared to pay, quote, a high economic price, unquote, in order to defend its values. Tuesday's remarks by German foreign minister came as Western nations threaten Russia with crippling sanctions if it invades Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell reports.
400 kilometers west of Moscow, over 100,000 Russian troops are deployed close to the Ukrainian border. Ukraine and the West fear another invasion is imminent. Russia claims its deployment is to guard against NATO's expansion. Against that tense backdrop, Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock met her Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow Tuesday and said Germany would defend Europe's fundamental values.
We have no other option but to defend those common rules, even if this means paying a high economic price.
In talks with the U.S. earlier this month, Moscow demanded that NATO pull back its deployments in Eastern Europe and promise never to admit Ukraine as a member. The United States and its allies dismissed those demands. Meantime, Russia refuses to pull back its troops from the border.
We explained that we cannot accept any demands regarding the actions of our armed forces on our own land.
The German-Russian talks come amid another week of intense diplomacy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is due to visit Kiev and Berlin as the West aims to present a united front. On Tuesday, NATO's Secretary General held talks with Germany's Chancellor and reiterated the alliance position.
The risk of a conflict is real. NATO allies call on Russia to de-escalate, and any further aggression will come with a high cost for Moscow.
Germany said that cost could include the continued suspension of Nord Stream 2, the recently completed pipeline that can take Russian gas directly to Germany. Moscow is eager for the gas and the money to start flowing.
What is sometimes forgotten is that the current status, if played well, does Europe give also some leverage.
Meanwhile, Britain this week began delivering what it described as light anti-armor weapons to Ukraine. The United States has already supplied anti-tank weapons to Kiev and said the supply of military hardware would be stepped up if Russia invades. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As winter bites, Europe is facing a gas shortage with lower volumes of exports from Russia, forcing a big spike in prices. But the volatility of Russia's gas supply could be about to get worse as Moscow plans to build a new pipeline to China, which could give Russia the power to sell gas to the highest bidder. Again, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
From the frozen expanses of Siberia, Russia is already sending some natural gas to China. The Power of Siberia 1 pipeline opened in 2019, tapping the gas fields in Russia's Far East to help fuel the Chinese economy. Tom Marzek-Mansa is head of gas analytics at ICIS.
Power Siberia 1 uses gas that is not connected to the fields that can supply the European market. So it's not a question at the moment, at least, of gas from Russia going to China being as a loss to gas that could go into Europe.
But that could soon change. Moscow and Beijing are close to agreeing a second pipeline, the Power of Siberia 2, which would double gas exports from Russia to China. It would cross through Mongolia and into the power-hungry industrial regions near Beijing. It would also join up Russia's internal gas network, connecting China with the same gas fields in Russia's Yamal Peninsula that supply Europe. Again, Tom Marzek-Mansa.
It does give Gazprom, as that major exporter, the optionality to direct gas to one market over another.
That could give Russia considerable leverage, says Philip Medunich of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Technically, it is hard to tell whether the pricing system will be designed in a way that there is going to be the possibility to sell to the highest bidder. But I think that Russia in its intent is definitely eyeing in this direction to be able to use it as a leverage, at least rhetorically, in the coming decade.
Russia has massed over 100,000 troops on the border with Ukraine. The West has threatened crippling sanctions if Russia invades. And there are other incentives for Moscow to find new customers for its gas, say analysts. Again, Tom Marzek-Mansa of ICIS.
The trajectory of the European Union, in particular in terms of decarbonisation, is that gas will have a diminishing role over the medium to long term.
But navigating a new Chinese market won't be easy for Moscow, says Medunich.
China is well known for using its political, economic, also military posture and weight, and to be a tough negotiating partner, and allegedly also considering itself rather as the big hegemon here, and Russia as the junior partner.
There is speculation that the deal for the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline could be signed during next month's Winter Olympic Games in Beijing, but there's yet to be any official confirmation. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
President Joe Biden took office on an optimistic note. He promised to unite Americans after 4 years of what analysts call the divisive politics of former President Donald Trump. Biden also promised to tackle the COVID pandemic, poverty, the racial divide, and to rebuild the country's crumbling infrastructure. As his administration marks the first year in office, January 20th, Observers say those lofty aspirations have collided with political reality. These are some important policies are on the verge of being derailed in the face of Republican opposition. For more on the mood inside the White House, I spoke with VOA correspondent Anita Powell.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has been asked about this a few times. Critics will point out that inflation is high, the pandemic is still not over, and so on and so forth. But she says we weren't expecting this to be an easy first year, given the fact that we stepped into office amid a pandemic, under the shadow of the January 6th Capitol riots, and as the economy is on shaky ground because of the pandemic, and as America is increasingly politically divided. And she points out that employment is better than it has been under the Trump administration, the economy is rebounding, that more Americans are vaccinated than when they stepped into office, so on and so forth. So the White House is really looking at this in a glass half full way, whereas a lot of Americans, 10 of them actually, are pretty critical of Biden administration. That's showing in his approval numbers.
What has the White House said has been its main success in this one year? What has been its main disappointment?
My colleague Patsy Wittakuswara, our White House bureau chief, asked Jen Psaki this specific question, and the White House kind of stumbled on that one. They pointed out that America is back. It's rejoined a lot of alliances. It's back on the world stage. They're engaging in diplomacy. Domestically, they note that the economy has rebounded relative to other global economies after the pandemic, that the economy has recovered faster than they thought was going to happen. And that is a success. And also that they're making progress on the pandemic, that so many Americans are vaccinated. So critics are quick to note, lots of Americans have held out and are still unvaccinated. So the Biden White House has said domestically that what they've really succeeded in is pushing through these stimulus plans, pushing for legislation, passing this infrastructure bill, and also getting more Americans protected from the virus.
Is the White House planning a reset, or it just wants to continue with its policies?
Jen Psaki actually gave a somewhat flippant answer. She said, we didn't expect this to be easy. Things that we do in the White House are not easy. And then she said, quite glibly, we could pass legislation about bunny rabbits and ice cream, and Americans might get behind that, but we're not here to do easy things. We're going to keep doing what we're doing, even if that means that they run into obstacles, like we've seen with the president's quest to pass both voting rights legislation and this large spending bill, that both of them have stalled.
What has it been like covering the White House for this past year? Gauge your experience on what other reporters, how they covered the White House during the previous former President Trump.
Well, I think one of the big differences under the Biden White House versus the Trump White House was that the Trump White House seemed to have pretty frequent surprises, talking about surprises both rhetorical level and also at the policy level, where President Trump would engage in big policy changes without necessarily consulting everybody down the line. The Biden administration is very much on message, very coordinated, very thought out. Some critics say that they don't give the media enough time and enough space to, you know, really interrogate them and to do our work. And that is something that the White House has tried to respond to. President Biden is having his first press conference of the year on Wednesday, partially as a response to that, and also partially because of pressure from the White House Correspondents Corps that has said, you know, we need to see the president in front of us answering questions directly. So this is definitely much more, I guess, in-step, coordinated administration. Whether that really benefits the American people is something that Americans are going to find themselves debating. But so far, this is a much more, I guess you could say, coordinated machine than the Trump White House appeared to be.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with me from Washington. The United Nations reports emergency teams are on standby to provide humanitarian assistance to thousands of victims of a volcanic eruption and tsunami on the South Pacific island of Tonga. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Planes carrying humanitarian aid are unable to land in Tonga until the island's main runway is cleared of a thick coating of ash from Saturday's undersea volcanic eruption. While a planned large-scale humanitarian operation is put on hold, UN officials say the government and local aid agencies are assessing the scale of damage and subsequent needs. They say the Tonga government confirms two people have been killed and 150 houses have been damaged and destroyed on the main island of Tongatapu. Jens Laerke is spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He says the latest reports indicate the country's capital, Nuku'alofa, has sustained a lot of infrastructure damage. He says there is much concern over the well-being of people on two small low-lying islands who so far have not been reached.
Clean water sources are another concern for the Tongan government, who have issued advice requesting that people only drink bottled water, as water sources may be contaminated from the ash, debris, and seawater. Assessments by the Tongan authorities are ongoing and should provide a better estimate of what is required.
The World Health Organization reports 89 displaced people are sheltering in evacuation centers on the island. Others, rendered homeless by the disaster, are staying with relatives and friends. WHO spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says the tsunami did extensive damage to the country's telecommunications infrastructure, including the undersea internet cable. However, he says the island's medical warehouses and health facilities are undamaged, fully functional, and able to treat people with health problems stemming from the calamitous event.
The concern, of course, is the around 2 centimeters of ash and dust that has fallen on Tonga Tapu, raising concerns of air pollution and potential contamination of water supplies. Said to avoid the consequences of ash, will remain indoors and use masks if going out and drink bottled water.
The WHO warns further volcanic activity cannot be ruled out and urges people to stay alert and seek higher ground if tsunami alerts are issued. Tonga is a COVID-free zone and has very strict protocols to preserve that status. UN officials note one of the first rules of humanitarian action is to do no more harm. They say they will make sure that all necessary protocols for entry into the country are followed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Scientists say Tonga's massive underwater volcanic eruption could deliver long-lasting damage to coral reefs, erode coastlines, and disrupt fisheries. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
The destruction from Tonga's massive underwater volcanic eruption is still being assessed, but scientists now warn that the damage could be long-lasting. The volcano has been releasing sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide, two gases that create acid rain. This could damage crops, including staples like taro, corn, and bananas, which locals depend on. Geologist Marco Brenner has been studying the eruption's impact via satellite photos.
So a lot of that ash and gas will remain within the stratosphere for quite a number of weeks and possibly months, and kind of circulate across the globe. The more immediate impact on Tonga especially was the ash fall directly from the cloud, which blanketed most of the Tongan landscape in a few centimeters of ash from what has been seen of satellite images. And that basically had an impact, basically water, drinking water sources, on vegetation, grazing for animals, etc., because the volcanic ash is toxic.
And it may not just be Tonga. Much of the rain could land on Fiji. Underwater, fish are at risk. Tonga's livelihoods depend on the ocean, but ash from the eruption could be harmful to marine life. Murky, ash-filled water near the volcano will deprive fish of food and wipe out spawning beds.
Certainly fisheries are likely to have been impacted by for instance, the murkiness of the water. So the eruption would have produced quite a lot of suspended particle in the ocean water. So that might impact fishing grounds. Ash fall could also have such an impact and could potentially cause changes in ocean surface acidification.
Meanwhile, surviving marine life will be forced to migrate. Even before the eruption, Tonga's reefs were threatened by disease outbreaks and the effects of climate change, including coral bleaching and increasingly strong cyclones.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. In Norway, mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik gave a Nazi salute on Tuesday as he arrived in court for a parole hearing that will decide if he should be released after spending more than a decade behind bars. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
He gave a Nazi salute as he walked into the courtroom. That's mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik on Tuesday, arriving for a parole hearing to decide if he should be released after spending more than a decade behind bars. The far-right extremist set off a car bomb in Oslo in July 2011 and then gunned down dozens of people, mostly teenagers, at a Labour Party youth camp. He killed 77 people in total. Now, seen with a shaven head and dressed in a dark suit, he re-entered the courtroom, thanks to a Norwegian law that allows anyone to apply for parole after 10 years. He carried signs, printed in English, including one that said, "Stop your genocide against our white nations and Nazi civil war." He was later told to stop displaying them as the prosecution presented its case. Addressing the court himself, Breivik blamed his crimes on online radicalization by a leaderless network of far-right extremists, which he said had motivated his attacks and brainwashed him.
First, I would like to talk about what happened, who I was, and who I am today. And some of the accounts will sound frightening to you and to the Norwegian public, but it is important and relevant and explains how brainwashed I was 10 years ago and how many are equally radical today.
42-year-old Breivik is serving Norway's maximum sentence of 21 years, which can be extended indefinitely if he is deemed a continued threat to society. Proceedings will take place over a maximum of 4 days in a prison gymnasium converted into a makeshift courtroom, with a decision expected about a week later.
That's Soria Ali of Reuters. North Korea says it conducted a test firing of, quote, tactical guided missiles, unquote, in its fourth round of missile launches this month. The announcement Tuesday came a day after South Korea's military detected North launching two ballistic missiles into the sea. North Korea has warned of stronger action after the Biden administration last week imposed fresh sanctions over its continued weapons test. Some experts say North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is reviving Pyongyang's old playbook in brinkmanship to extract concessions from Washington and neighbors. This as its severely sanctioned economy continues to decay under pandemic-related difficulties. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Observers say they see signs of progress in efforts to reopen Turkey's border with Armenia following talks in Moscow on normalizing relations. Ties have been cut since 1993, and analysts say renewing them could reshape the region. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, both sides need to overcome some obstacles.
Turkey closed its border with Armenia in 1993 after Armenian forces seized Azeri territory in fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. But with Azeri forces recapturing their territory in 2020, some analysts say the door has opened to restoring Turkish-Armenian relations. Sinan Ulgen is with the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies, a research organization in Istanbul.
Today, therefore, there is no clear barrier to this rapprochement between Turkey and Armenia, because, as we recall, it was on account of the occupation of these territories back in the early 1990s, 1993 to be specific, that Turkey had decided to close the border. So now that justification has disappeared. And on top of that, there are also positive messaging from Baku about the Turkey-Armenia rapprochement.
The Turkish and Armenian envoys met in Moscow last week for normalization talks. Both sides described those talks as constructive. Reopening the border would help tens of thousands of Armenians working in Turkey, many of whom must make the arduous journey home by bus via neighboring Georgia. But history could be an obstacle to rapprochement efforts. Armenia accuses Ottoman rulers of committing genocide among Turkey's Armenian minority during World War I. Ankara refuses to call it genocide and insists the deaths were part of the fallout of a civil war. But analysts suggest Yerevan does not want the past to threaten rapprochement efforts. Richard Giragorsian is director of Regional Studies Center.
It's a policy of no preconditions, meaning that normalization is not reconciliation. This is not about the Armenian genocide. This is simply the basic minimum of neighbors, establishing diplomatic relations and having open borders. Reconciliation will come later, with normalization as an important foundation.
Normalization of relations will help ease Ankara's strained ties with Washington, which has welcomed the diplomatic efforts. Congress has strongly criticized Turkey's policy, which has hurt Armenia's economy by denying the landlocked country access to the large Turkish market and transit routes, forcing Yerevan to depend on its Russian and Iranian neighbors. But some analysts say the reopening of the Turkish-Armenian border could ease that dependency.
That would have a huge impact on the region with regard of easing of cooperation, of a particular communication, so and transportation. The boost of cooperation between these two countries would diminish the role of Iran in the region entirely.
The announcement of new direct flights between Turkey and Armenia is the first fruit of rapprochement efforts. But clashes on the volatile Azeri-Armenian border last week left three dead, underscoring the risks that remain. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Somalia's worst drought in decades has millions of people dependent on food aid and thousands flocking to cities to escape hunger. At makeshift shelters on the outskirts of the capital, displaced people faced cramped conditions and poor sanitation in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Many fled their villages and came here to escape severe drought conditions. Mother of four, Muhubba Adam, is preparing a meal for her young children at the camp. She fled drought in her village in Lower Shabelle, some 90 kilometers away.
We had no rain for two consecutive seasons. Drought has devastated both livestock and farming, so we had to leave. We spent one day trekking all the way from Audigle to this neighborhood in Dainile.
But conditions here are also difficult. 56-year-old Nur Hassan Ali and his family fled their rural homes too. He looks weak as he navigates through the camp's shelters.
I was uprooted by drought and the suffering that we encountered, enduring two seasons without rains. My livestock began to die because of the long drought. I had to run away with my children and finally reached here. Here I don't have anything, and my children are hungry and don't have anything to eat.
Faiza Omar oversees the camp and works to keep track of the families arriving daily.
The Nizhda camp is home to 370 families who have recently been displaced by the drought and whose livestock have also been wiped out by the drought. So far, these people have not received any assistance, either from the government or from aid agencies. They lack shelter from the sun and the cold. They also do not have a place from which they can shield themselves in case it rains.
The drought and influx of people on the outskirts of Mogadishu is a burden on the city's health care system. City hospitals are still grappling with an upsurge of COVID-19 infections, and poor living conditions are another source of worry for health officials.
This drought comes at a time when we are grappling with the burden of recurrence of COVID-19, so this drought has only added a further burden on the already existing COVID-19 problem that has caused sickness and death. The drought has its own pain and plight as it causes the spread of the disease.
Somalia's government and UN humanitarian agencies have warned that millions are in urgent need of food assistance due to drought and new strains of COVID-19. Officials say thousands of refugees living in camps near Mogadishu remain vulnerable to waterborne disease due to poor sanitation, congestion, and access to clean water. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
the voice of America. Washington, ba ba ba